This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Asbrook, and joining me in the studio tonight is the Phil Pemberton Band with the high priestess of performance poetry and four-time National Grand Slam champion, the one-of-a-kind Patricia Smith.
I remember
But you have poetry, you say. And if you can tell me what poetry is, where the line is drawn between the beauty and the breathing of breath into something to make it beautiful, I will claim poetry as my own. Poets, this is a poem wearing all of your names. When I deserved to die, your unflappable mojo worked my last nerve and exposed it again to the open air. You engaged my throat, taught me once again the sweet hurt of singing my own songs. You flooded my inbox with attitude until I was mad enough to wrap my wounds in you, and you said, Patricia, come to us if the world bleeds through. You drove in from the city and backhanded me with every word I have heard you utter. Your clunky rhymes, your in your place but in your face verses, your falterings, your leaps for the sky, your works in progress. You jumped up and down on my heart, screaming, beat, beat. When I was wrong, you yelled it, beat. Beat, when there was nothing I could do but lie as a liar, flat on the earth under everyone, you bounced up and down on my chest until the irritation warmed that dead muscle and pulled it out onto the dance floor. We click our heels on rickety stages, slap our flat palms against hot mics to test the sizzle, and we talk it, and each syllable is a stroke. That's beautiful. It is inside me and beyond us. We are naked except for whatever words we have chosen to define a moment that can never be recaptured. We are the worst cliche. No one understands us. We are vague and perfect miracles taught to give voice to our sins. We stand before the clink glass congregation and howl and yammer and screech. We let the world lay its hands on us. I have tried my mouth on around all of your stories. I have lied my way into and out of them because that is what we do. I lost the line. I lost the line. Somewhere I lost the line that separates the beautiful from the strokes that make things beautiful. You found the line and erased it for good, knowing what poems will be born from this. Poets! Only your communal wail made me want to not die, not to die, to want to not die. Your hands are all over me, bomb clinging, small explosions on skin that I no longer believed could hold all of me inside. But you took a deep, deep breath, overpronounced the word human, and laid me down to sleep inside the bed those two syllables made. No one understands the religion that began us, that sustains and heals us. Poets, flawed and fallible, halting and doubtful, elegant, electric, I am growing again in your grasp. I could never love me like this.
That was Patricia Smith, along with Phil Pemberton on vocals, John Carey on bass guitar, and Jim Weston on percussion. Patricia Smith's Down for the Upstroke. Salman Rushdie once said that a poet's work is to name the unnameable, to point at frauds, to take sides, start arguments, shape the world, and stop it going to sleep. Since the events of September 11th, many have turned to the wise words of poets for insight in the troubled world around them. Patricia Smith riffs on the voices of those who are not heard, skinheads, mourning mothers, undertakers. The events of 9/11 have unearthed a whole new crew of strangled voices. We're talking this hour about the life and lifeblood of poetry in the world since 9/11. What voices are you listening for that you still haven't heard? What do you hear in the passionate voice of Patricia Smith? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Welcome, Patricia Smith.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Oh, it's awfully, awfully good to have you.
My old buddy.
My old friend. And you just keep on going. Hey, we are vague and perfect miracles, you just said. Poets, only your communal wail made me not want to die. If I didn't mangle that too badly.
You did just fine.
Are you talking about after 9/11?
I'm talking about each time there's been some sort of, you know, monumental crisis in my life, and 9/11 was surely one of those, that it was the community of poets that kept me rooted. And there was a while when I could not write a word. And I was talking to other poets, and we all had the same problem. It just seemed like there's nothing I can write that can pull all this together and make sense of it. Mm. So we were all just kind of stunned and numbed for a while. But we stayed together thinking that, well, this is our job. If we can't do it now, eventually we're going to have to try and make sense of this. And, like you said, it's us that people will turn to make some sense out of it.
What is your job, Madam Poet?
What is my job? Well, at first I thought my job was just to put pretty words together and have them be pleasing to people and have them go home and feel better about themselves.
They did that, too, you know.
Yes, they did that. You know, I realized early on that I was engaged in an oral art and that I had a responsibility. I did a couple of poems when I first started out that were basically just for me. I used to, when I first started, I would write these therapeutic breakup of love affair, mad at the world poems.
This is 88, 89, maybe a little longer.
Yeah,
even.
You know, I'm a young girl.
Yeah, sure.
But I'd stuff them in a kitchen drawer, pull them out, read them whenever I got the chance. And it wasn't until I started reading in front of audiences that people would come up and say, you know, I have felt that way. I just didn't know there was a way to express it. And then I began to feel a real responsibility to interpret events, moments, life changes for people, and have them either relate to it or say, I can do better than that, or I can compare to that, or that's nothing like my experience, just to give them some sort of bench point.
You know, I have heard you do that maybe the first time 10 years ago now, and you pulled me up out of my lazy chair and got me to a poetry slam in Cambridge, and it really just took the lid off for me. I absolutely loved it. But I wonder now, after September 11th, the burden must just feel overwhelming, or the crisis, you describe personal crises that poetry has helped you respond to. Here's a crisis, not only personal, it's national, it's global, it's vast. How do you begin, how did you begin to chip away at it, to find a little chink in the armor of that thing and get into it?
Well, you have to remember, too, that it's not only what you as the poet is bringing to the table, it's what the listener is bringing. So you're not developing the experience for them. You're adding your experience to what they're coming with. And so you're not really having to do all the work. I mean, you've got a listening. They're looking for answers. They're already searching for answers. It's not like you're saying, this is how I feel, so this is how much you must feel.
So you listen, and in listening, you also hear, you also create.
It's an interactive experience, right. Mm. You only get, when you're in front of an audience, for instance, you only can give the energy that you're getting back.
What's the whisper that you were hearing, that you're hearing now, post 9/11? What are you hearing that people want to hear you riff off on?
One of the things that I think is happening, I've written a lot of poems about family now. Before, I was kind of like, oh, well, my mother doesn't really want to hear that, and I don't want to write about my son. But now I want to cement those relationships, see where they are, because I see how abruptly they can end. And I think a lot of people are moving close and writing more personal poetry than they were before.
We're talking with the high priestess of performance poetry. I don't know. It's out of some PR bump we got here. Okay. You don't like it. We're going to put it right away. But it's Patricia.
Well, I didn't say I didn't
like it. Oh, okay. We'll lay it on twice then.
Oh, okay.
Patricia Smith, she is a performance poet extraordinaire, and she's been rousing and sharing passions for a long, long time. Post 9/11, we want to hear it all the more. You can join our conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. What are the themes, the voices you're waiting for, needing to hear post 9/11? Patricia Smith, we count on you in all years, this one included, to not only look at the crisis, but to celebrate life at the same time. Play something else for us. Play Sex and Music.
Oh, of course.
Or is play the right word? Recite, sing, perform?
Perform.
Give it to us.
Priestessize.
Oh, yeah. Patricia Smith and the Phil Pemberton Band. Mm-hmm.
and music. You can blame most things, but not everything, on one thing or the other thing. We are either being coaxed toward the dance floor with a succession of hips, starlit phone calls, and promises of pressure. We are either being coaxed toward the dance floor, or we are already dancing. The music, whatever it is mean and angular, making us slice through the air with flailing arms, pricking our buttocks with pins. Imagine my disgust at discovering that I am actually that abrupt, readable, uncomplicated, that I can find nothing else in me worth noting except that heat and those two ways to release it. Sex, caging it in those four electric square inches where mine touches his, ready, teddy to be steadily knocking something up against something else, or music, gracing it with irrepressible backbeat, letting it loose in that clicking clack of gotta sing. Did you hear it? Where do I buy it? Can't help but move to that. Blues be miserable all over my skin. Pockmark and breakout, scrape scratch. How you fight that itch? Dear Ann Landers, dear Miss Abby, Lord have mercy, Miss All-Knowing White Lady, this ain't no common problem. It's I can't stand up or I can't sit down. I'm 46. On the whoop-de-dun side of whoop-de-doo, should be laying this chaos floor, lean and languid life, light radio, hot chai, spinach salad. Should have given up on the search for a rhythm to rock my innards, a kiss that puts me on crutches, and all night long and all next morning too. I should be taking the long way around the dance floor, my hips in quiet alignment under whatever passes for shame that week, orderly with just a maybe toe tap. After all, I'm some child's grandmother. I need to understand that sex is rumored to be a strictly reproductive function. No need at all for that sliver of ice, the silver utensils, the banshee howl, the two-way mirror, that Todd Rundgren record, the mercy circle of the mouth, that spread eagle, those throat kisses, that candle stub, the slow drip of any liquid, the pinch, the reading of Sharon Olds, that Japanese fan, the rug burn, the chipped plaster, the repeating of my name, the repeating of my name, name, the second coming. Maybe I am too past center to have my heart drumming this insanely. Maybe if it wasn't all tied together in my head. Music leads to sex, leads to music, leads to sex, leads to music, leads to sex. Oh, wait a minute. If it wasn't for the clock of music imitating the pulse of someone, I could stop short this lap dance in my own lap. Imagine my surprise upon identifying the two things I need to live. I'm as basic and decipherable as 4/4 time. I need to be twirled in a limelight wash to music with a beat bleeding through me. I need to off-key sing along with a huge hip chaka. I need James Taylor to rock me in silk rhymes. And I need to keep lighting that fire that I keep needing to douse. And oh, there is something so beauteous in the burn.
Performance poet Patricia Smith and the Phil Pemberton Band with Patricia Smith's Sex and Music. Wow, it's great to have you. We love talking to poets because we believe we can talk about anything with you. Since 9/11, people have told us in New York and around the country, they said, you know what? These are public health people. There's an explosion of sex going on after 9/11. Can you figure that? Can you figure that? What do you make of
that? Well, sure. You know, you get up and you get ready to go to work and your significant other taps you on the shoulder and you think, you know, I could leave and never see this person again. Mm. So you then have the best sex you've ever had in your life.
Let's grab it right now. That repeating of my name, my name. All right, we got the 4 electric square inches going on here with Patricia Smith. You can join us. We're talking about poetry post 9/11. What you need, what we all need. What's the new turf that only poets can reach? Is there a truth post 9/11 that only poets can tell? Join us at 1-800-423-8255. This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We'll be right back. This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're live in the studio with the Phil Pemberton Band and the poet Patricia Smith.
Woke up this morning in this crazy world. I'm all alone, I pray. I said, Lord, don't you let it get crazier than it is today. I'm not the child. Not the child that I used to be. I know I'm not the man that you wanna see. It's true, that's become my reality. Look what you've done. Look what you've done to me. Crazy.
Woman, quite obviously not trying to fly, who fell with her legs closed, arms pressed against the front of her body while primly clutching her purse. You didn't topple, cartwheel, or plummet. You believed that your descent, while swift, would end tenderly, and that immediately after there would certainly be things to attend to. While others fell past you, screeching for mercy and splayed like stars, you aimed the pinpoint of your body towards a future that included checkbooks, snapshots of squirming children, a scarlet stump of lipstick. There would be need for those things again. In your keenly ordered mind, this vertical drop was merely inconvenience. Everyone knows that down is the only direction allowed in the elevator of the soul. You didn't hurdle, flail, or pinwheel. Your eyes straight ahead, your sweet drumming heart struggling to raise a fuss, you seem most concerned with decorum, the proper way for a lady to manage adversity. I watched your fall and readied myself, for I have been called a lady too. I will be here to help you to your feet, to brush strands of the sky from your eyes. These are difficult days for poets. We have at our disposal every letter of every syllable of every word ever written or spoken in any language. This supply falls short when I attempt to scribble the word breath and discover that it can no longer conjure sound. Somewhere below the line of the realized earth lie thousands of sentences with their periods on fire. I can dream vividly of the man with his skin fused to his shirt, of hands, shoes, and cell phones, sudden gifts in the grit and rubble, of a blue Toyota Camry sitting for 9 days in the train station lot at Tarrytown, of have you seen him, her, them, he was, she is, brown eyes, slight lip, tattoo, of thousands of mothers suddenly convinced that their children can fly, and most certainly did. I can make my dreams horrible. During sleep, I can set monstrous eyes deep into the pink, chubby faces of angels. I can too roughly grab the shoulders of a stout brown woman who is plastering yet another flyer to yet another pole. Too roughly, I can shout, your daughter is not magic. She cannot hear you calling. She is not lost and thriving in some hellish pocket of air beneath us. She is dead. I can dream myself saying this. And I can dream the mother spitting into my face, pulling deep from her ravaged soul, deep from her weary and spitting and screaming, who in the hell do you think you are? You are not God, but I can dream that I am God. I have been called many things by those I have loved. Caldonia, Angel, Ignorant, Irreplaceable, Possessive, Possessed. I am crazy for the people I love. And I am evil, my nappy hair spewing sparks when the world threatens them. When the city is, when we are, when our hearts, when the world is back to normal, when we can fly, drive, walk, entertain without believing that it is possible to die from it, when we stop looking at every brown skin, silk hair, scraggly beard, turban with slit eyes, when everyone who hates us and everyone we hate is dead, when the war is over and our boys, our husbands, our sons, our brothers, our sisters, our daughters are back home safe on this luscious soil, and the rubble that was the towers is gone, and the ghosts have slithered away, when it's okay, okay to get all sputtered up about a sale at Macy's every night now. Okay, it's okay, it's okay for someone sitting next to you at a bar. It's okay for someone sitting next to you to say, hey, has anyone looked at Gary Condit for this World Trade Center terrorism thing? I mean, it's certainly got the focus off of him. He could pull that intern's head out of his freezer and say, hey, hey, look at this, and nobody would have time for him when it's okay to laugh at that. When you can listen to this poem and feel strangely removed from it, as if the things within are things that happen to someone else, and you are merely an observer, covered only momentarily with dust. Some odd occurrence related by your best buddy, Dan Rather, a vicious rumor, something to be debunked and devalued. Damn if there's not a gap in the skyline. When you can finally smell air and not smell them. When you are once again counting calories and comparing light beers and not caring if Whitney Houston is hooked or unhooked. When things are back to what they were before they weren't anymore. My neighbor will finally pull the American flag from the tip of his pickup truck's antenna and stare at me in silence, forgetting that he had called me sister, high-fived me, talked about black and white united against a common foe. When the wind comes, when we believe that there is no longer a foe, there must be a foe, there must always be a foe. That's the moment he will catch my eye and hold it and think to himself, what the hell are you looking at, nigger? My granddaughter is obsessed with the drawing of stars. Each point must be perfect, meticulously measured, twinkling beyond reason. We have experimented with the most efficient ways to manufacture whole crayoned parades of starlight. We have filled entire pages with nighttime skies where no fiery wink is allowed to flaw. Why are you so worried about how the stars look, I asked. Grandma, she says, in that way she has that makes me feel feeble and clueless. A star has got to be perfect before God lets it fall.
Patricia Smith and the Phil Pemberton Band here in our studio with a poem called To the Woman, quite obviously not trying to fly, who fell with her legs closed, arms pressed against her body while primly clutching her purse. Patricia Smith, we know you often write your poetry from what you see in the world. Your repertorial eye, did you see a woman fall?
Yep. I saw it on a film clip. And what struck me about it was that she was holding her purse, that she would think,
ready for the next thing.
Have to get my purse. There's some sort of, I don't know what kind of life is beyond this, but there's some sort of life where I will need the things in my purse. And it was sad, but it was heartening in a way.
I hear things in that poem that we all share, and I hear things that maybe are really unique. You say, I'm crazy for the people I love, and I'm evil when the world threatens them.
Mm-hmm.
You saw a lot of that feeling in America this last fall.
Yeah.
You shared it.
Well, you know, what it makes me think about, they're always talking about when a child is pinned beneath a car or something, that the mother suddenly has the strength to lift the car.
Mm-hmm.
And there is, I mean, I didn't know anyone at all who was killed in the 911 mm-hmm. events, but mm-hmm. I'm angry, and I look very closely at my family and people who are close to me and know that I would have to and when I say avenge, I don't mean I would go around, you know, shooting into crowds of people. But that energy and that anger has to go somewhere. And I can sort of imagine how the families of the victims feel.
And then I hear something that's not necessarily shared that brings lines back. You talk about your neighbor's pickup truck with the flag on the antenna, and it's been all, hey, my sister, we're all in this crisis together. But once again, you anticipate he'll stare and that race hate will be there again.
Oh, it's already started.
And then I heard you say, but and then what? I missed that. And then what?
He pulls the flag off his truck and begins to look at me with suspicion again.
And then
forgets that I was no longer a foe and thinks to himself, what are you looking at, nigger?
Mm-hmm. And then you feel we're back to normal? Or?
I have someone in mind, actually, that is roughly approaching that point. Yeah.
Yeah,
that we keep talking about things getting back to normal, and that's, you know, we think of it as being a good thing, but it's not always. I mean, everyone was singing We Are the World and saying, you know, here, I've got my flag. Do you have yours? Mm-hmm. And I just think that we need to remember that camaraderie, that banding together when things outwardly are back to normal.
I have so many questions for you. We're talking with Patricia Smith tonight. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. What do you hear in the voice of Patricia Smith? Is there a truth post 9/11? That only poets can tell. Okay, I have questions for you. Number one, what kind of performance poet do you think Osama bin Laden is? Did you see the video?
Yeah, I don't think he's a performance poet who's performing for himself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, it's my glory in the world is what everyone's going to think of me, and so he's got this picture of what he wants to be. And
you've seen his type?
Have I seen his type? No one has ever seen his type.
Okay.
No, I don't. But I can't think of anything that comes out of his mouth and related to poetry anyway. So.
Mm-hmm. Next, how honest, how open do you think America's post 9/11 conversation with itself has been about what all this meant, about what all this was? What's missing?
How honest has the conversation? I think there was sort of a flashpoint immediately after the event where we could have captured a complete and total honesty that was born from fright, anger, bewilderment. Now you're already starting to see that gloss over. You know, we're back to, I guess I heard you earlier talking about the tabloid television. I mean, we're looking for diversions that we don't have to think about, this kind of mindless, and that bothers me.
So what's the fish that got away that we might have caught in that moment when we're all blasted open?
While we all said to each other, this could happen to anyone, I think there were a lot of us who did not believe that still.
What do you mean?
That, you know, we say there, you know, there but for the grace of God. And it only what we're striving toward is to distance ourselves from it. And I think we should have been striving to pull ourselves closer
Walk
to it.
Walk straight up to it.
Walk straight in and confront it and let it do to us what it will do.
Mm-hmm.
But instead, we were like, okay, what can I find over here that will pull me away and make me not have to identify with
insulate
that.
Me a little bit.
Yeah.
We're talking with Patricia Smith about the poets and the role of poetry post 9/11. What's the new turf that only poets can reach? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Vanessa is on the line. Welcome, Vanessa. You're on the air.
Oh, thank you very much. Very exciting to be here as I'm driving in my car.
Good to have you.
Be careful.
Yeah, drive safely.
Thank you. I'm trying to focus. Well, I've had the pleasure of seeing Patricia perform in Cambridge before.
Isn't it great?
Yeah, it's terrific. It really is, and it's great to hear you on the radio. And I'm calling because I come at the arts in a couple different perspectives, both as a songwriter and also as an arts events producer. And not long after September 11th, I was producing a visual arts event in Open Studios in the Boston area and was struck by the awe and the support of the audience coming out to this event, even on a weekend when people were being told to stay home. And it was just such a beautiful event to see the support by audience of the arts and also what was gained by the artists from seeing that, feeling that support. And
give us a question for the poet we've got right here,
yes,
Vanessa.
Yes. So here it comes. As a songwriter, I was struck silent when I saw Ground Zero. And what I'm so impressed about by you is that you seem to bypass your emotional and mental censorship. You find the words, you find the ways of expressing yourself. And I love the way you combine music into that. And I guess my question for you is, how do you do that? What is your process of finding the words and not allowing your internal censorship to say, this isn't appropriate, or...
Vanessa, it's a good question, and thanks for your call. Drive safely. Patricia, how about it?
Mm-hmm. I think there was a point that I reached. The way I came to poetry basically was by getting up on stage and doing it. I realized that it was supposed to be in the faces and ears of the audience. And at some point, I had to realize that in order... I was doing it for the audience, but I was also doing it to move myself from a place that wasn't comfortable for me into some place where everything was as close to fully realized as possible. And I had to give myself permission to use words that may bother me, that might bother my audience, to express sentiments that... if you're holding them inside, there's no reason why they can't be, you know, put out into the open air. And once you do that, it's really liberating. But it's a wall that a lot of artists run up against. It's like, okay, I'm going to be, you know, great, and I'm going to sort of open myself up to this audience. But there's still kind of a wall that sometimes we don't see, then we can't go beyond. And I just gave myself permission to go beyond that. It's like, if I can read it alone in my room and it puts me in a safer place in my head, there's no reason I can't read it out, you know, to an audience. So I strive to be as... there's an undercurrent running through most poetry, and I'm trying to get down where I can actually touch the current. And that involves, you know, sometimes really struggling for the words. But when I've hit them, I know it. I know it because of what I feel when I do the poem, even by myself in my room. But in the faces of people who are in the audience when I do it, I know that I've finally gotten to the base of what I was trying to say. And it's something that comes with practice, too. A lot of people who can't do what they do in front of an audience and get that immediate feedback, it's harder. Mm-hmm. It's a lot harder, you know, when you're writing for an editor or something like that. But... when the audience is right there and they're able to come up and say, I love that, I hated that, and this is why, you begin to revise your work to get closer to what they need.
We're listening tonight, and we're going to hear more. Patricia Smith, just before the break, one question. You know, poets describe personal crises with great intensity. Is a public crisis that different?
No. I mean, the September 11th was really personalized to me. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think if something affects you that much, it affects all your personal relationships. It affects the way you look at it.
So. We're talking with performance poet Patricia Smith about poetry post 9/11. What are the themes, the voices you're waiting, needing to hear? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. This is Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're live in the studio with the Phil Pemberton Band and the poet Patricia Smith.
This is not an abstract rant, but the story of my son, Damon, my errant angel, budding dreadhead, who phones from bondage to say that a cellmate plans to attack him with a sock crammed with dead batteries. This is the definition of justice somewhere. I sit home imagining the carnage, picturing dreams spilling from his head. This is a collect call from an inmate at Middlesex Correctional Facility. Mama, I'm scared. Your conversation may be monitored. Mama, I'm sick. I cough all night. My house is on fire and my baby is in the house. My house is on fire and my baby is. My house is on fire and my children are in the house of correction. They are lined up, linked, muscle and sweet sinew. In their gray jumpsuits, they are raindrops swept sideways, falling out of no sky, praying in busted rhymes to the last surviving original gangster. Down the line with me now, murder, yes, child rape, yes, possession of a barely controlled substance, yes,
violating probation. Yes, my dear's baby boy, hair kinked with sweat, sheared off, street strut tired now, cuffing the receiver with calloused hands. Mama, mama, I'm sick. I cough all night. Your call may be monitored. Visits, 6 to 9 Saturday night. I kiss the glass separating us and sense his stutter through it. His bow legs and leaping laughter all buried beneath all this new muscle. And what ears do I listen with when he says, Mama, I think they're going to kill me in here. Somewhere on the long play, there's a rhyme for that. Somewhere along the road, there's a sign for that. Somewhere in the Bible, there's a rule against that. I love him madly. This conversation may be recorded, but only repeated once. My house is on fire and my children are in the house. My house is on fire and my children are in the house. My house is on fire and my children. My house. My house. What's that smell? It's my house. My house is on fire, and that's the sick, sweet smell of children flaming. My house is on fire, and my children are in the house. My house is on fire, and your children are in that house. I have given birth for 25 years. If my son is killed in his cell, I will simply birth him again, already equipped with ankle cuffs, ready to be chained to something, anything, an idea, a wall, even a man who could be his twin. How long has it been since we sang a song of shackled? Shackled big man crying into the phone, shackled home girl singing past her gum, shackled poet woman saying she's chained to life. But what does she know? Her son's in jail anyway. Our children are small explosions. They get way too hot in the midst of burning. We left them in the house, safe, behind locked doors. Mistook their first screams for singing. Popped our hips in the club while the television blurred their souls. They are chained to each other, and even the chains are on fire. What sparked the flame? Who lit the match? What sparked the flame? Who lit the match? My house is on fire and my children are in the house. My house is on fire and my children are in the house. My house is on fire and my children are in the house. My house on fire. My children are in the house. I don't care who brings the water.
The Phil Pemberton Band and poet Patricia Smith with her poem, Smoldering Child. Patricia, I know your son Damon. Tell me he's out of jail.
He's out of jail.
Oh, thank God. He's okay.
Yep.
He's such a beautiful boy.
I know. He's a
handsome, the man now.
He's a
I know.
Devil. Yeah, he's out. He was in jail for 2.5 years. He's out. He's good. He learned a lot. One of the things that taught him so much was... he would see guys that were there who would leave,
mm-hmm.
and the guards would say, see you in a few weeks.
We don't want to hear.
And the guys would come back.
Hey, your refrain, my house is on fire and my children are in the house, is one that anybody in this country has got to hear and feel anytime, but especially after 9/11. And the whole thing leads me to ask you, we've only got a minute left, is there a distinctively black response to 9/11?
Mm-hmm.
A lot of guys in prison. What, I
is
don't
there
know.
Distinctively black?
Well,
you
I
know,
don't know. You wrote this one after 9/11.
Yeah, I did. I don't think there's a distinctively black response. I think there was an initial suspicion of the patriotic fervor.
Mm, yeah,
you know, I mean,
yeah.
And we've got this whole thing going on now with the statue. And well, I don't know if you've talked about that, but. There's a memorial, a 911 memorial. And
oh, yeah,
changing
and should it be all
the
white or should it
yeah,
be diverse?
Yeah, yeah, you know, so there's a strange sort of suspicion. I'm sure we felt everything as deeply. But now, like I said, there's the separations are beginning to show themselves again.
Patricia Smith, the time has just flown by and
it
how
has.
We regret it. God almighty,
it
thank
has.
You for coming in
time.
Here.
Thanks. I want to thank my boys, too.
I want to thank them. Phil Pemberton on vocals, Josh Caray on beautiful bass guitar, and Jim Weston on percussion. It's the Phil Pemberton Band. And Patricia Smith and the Phil Pemberton Band, if you're in the Boston area, will be performing tomorrow night, Saturday, at the All Asia Cafe in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Saturday night, 7 to 9 p.m. Patricia Smith, it's just a sight for sore eyes. It's a song for sore ears to see you. Please come back. Do you promise?
I would love to.
It's great to have you.
Just whistle. I'll be back.
Hey, I know how to whistle. I may not be a poet, but I do know how to whistle. Patricia Smith and the Phil Pemberton Band. You can continue this conversation online. WBUR.org. Click on Special Coverage Forums. In a moment, I'm going to be joined by our special coverage news analyst, Jack Beatty. But first, the sounds of the week.
I do not feel even the slightest concern about their treatment. They are being treated vastly better than they treated anybody else over the last several years, and vastly better than was their circumstance when they were found.
For the 650 U.S. troops set to arrive, this will be a radically different front from Afghanistan. Instead of sand and snow, they'll deal with piercing heat and a tropical jungle in what could be a protracted guerrilla war, bringing up memories of Vietnam.
Instead of... We must think anew and act responsibly. We can and should postpone a portion of the future tax cuts that overwhelmingly benefit the wealthiest taxpayers.
It might have been even worse, said Israeli police. The bat mitzvah party was at its height. The main course served people dancing when, eyewitnesses said, a tall man burst in, spraying his automatic weapon at...
Today I'm announcing the filing of criminal charges against John Walker Lind, an American citizen who was captured in Afghanistan fighting for the Taliban.
I think we are on a path that will take us where we want to go. And what we have to do is to be patient, to remain committed to the diplomatic track, to recognize that this is a time of high tension when you have military forces in proximity to one another.
This whole situation is a crisis. My profession is in crisis, and my firm is being questioned.
There's Don Rumsfeld on the Guantanamo prisoners, chopper blades over the Philippines with the echo of tropical Vietnam, Ted Kennedy saying, we've got to cut the tax cuts, Ashcroft announcing the prosecution of John Walker Lind, American Taliban, more terror in Israel, gunfire at a bat mitzvah, Secretary of State Colin Powell in India, and finally the head of Arthur Andersen being pulled down and around in the Enron scandal. Jack Beatty, another barrel full hill here, and in the middle of it, this Enron scandal, maybe the first domestic story since September 11th of last year to be on a scale that it really nudges into the picture of 9/11 coverage.
It really does, along with special sections in newspapers. Mm. And you know, in thinking about it, you could call this, if this were a drama, it would be called conflict of interest. Within Enron, it had conflict. It suborned its accountants by essentially who were also its consultants. It suborned its own board through contracts, through favors, through other things. And it sort of pulled the wool over the eyes of its investment bankers. Outside now, and in the investigation of Enron, we also have conflict of interest. Mm. The head of the Securities and Exchange Commission is against separating the function of requiring accounting firms to separate their consulting from their auditing. Mm-hmm. And he's opposed to that, and he used to represent the Arthur Andersen and other firms. We have a congressional investigation under Senator Lieberman going on, but Senator Lieberman was one of those in Congress who stopped the prior occupant of the chair of the Securities and Exchange Commission from separating the consulting from the auditing functions of accountants. And finally, within the administration, we hear from the Washington Post today, we have no less than 36 people who have financial interest or had financial interests in Enron. Where is Diogenes going to find his honest man here with all this conflict of interest?
Is anyone not bought off in one way or another?
Yeah.
Wow.
It's a system here.
It is a system, but you get the sense from the critique coming from all sides now, even George Will weighing in, saying this isn't right, this is pirate capitalism, that maybe there'll be a systematic look at this system.
Well, let's hope, and let's hope it begins with campaign finance reform. There was a rally by Common Cause the other day in Washington saying, this is our moment. Here's the issue we need. And they're only a couple of votes removed from getting it dislodged in a discharge petition to have a vote on it in the House floor.
There you go. All it takes is a $100 billion corporate disaster to finally maybe get campaign finance reform.
Right.
Jack Beatty, you've been looking at Saudi Arabia, too, and the rumblings out of Saudi Arabia about those U.S. troops that Osama bin Laden doesn't want there.
Well, you know, in effect, it looks like bin Laden is going to get one of his aims in this jihad. One of the aims was to get the United States out of Saudi Arabia.
What's the evidence he's going to get that, Jack?
Well, there's a long piece in today's Washington Post, pretty well sourced from Saudi sources and American sources, saying the Saudis want us to go. They figure we're too much of a hazard. We get their radicals too angry, and it's not worth the candle anymore. And they're also fearful that we're going to beat up on Iraq again, and they don't want that from their bases. So bin Laden may get one of the things he wants from this attack, if you will. I mean, I don't know to say that he has a rational motive, but that was one of them. Get the U.S. out of Saudi Arabia.
How on earth would that be wrapped up and spun?
I have no idea, although it probably would be a net good for this country, too, to get out of that shaky and corrupt kingdom.
Perhaps, but what about just the simple logistical advantage of being there? What's the alternative militarily?
Well, they're talking now about over the horizon, you know, use our carriers to have our air power, to project our air power. That was talked about in 1990 as an alternative to basing forces in Saudi Arabia. And in retrospect, it looks like we should have taken that alternative.
Maybe. Though those oil wells are still there
They're still there.
Vulnerable, and yeah. Saddam Hussein is as strong as he's ever been since the last war.
Yes, and just as vicious.
We also hear Secretary of Defense Don Rumsfeld saying, you know, that famous phrase, "I do not feel even the slightest concern over the treatment of these al-Qaeda prisoners in Guantanamo." We've talked about this week, Jack, but do you think many Americans are concerned about it or not?
Somehow, I don't think so, although we're going to hear, I think the Red Cross is going to actually take a look at it and see how they're doing.
And that's got to be a good thing that international convention is
yes,
complied with,
yes.
That the International Red Cross is
right,
in there.
Right, because their whole status, whether they're prisoners of war or whatever they are, has been anomalous, and so we don't know.
But we don't want to destroy the precedent of the Red Cross being able to bring some
right.
kind of succor and awareness to
that's
prisoners
right.
of conflict.
That's right. That's
that
right.
could come back to bite our own soldiers in a serious way someday.
Yeah. Yeah. And Secretary Rumsfeld has said that, you know, there are continual yells from these people saying we're going to kill Americans. But according to the base commander, only one person said that. So the secretary is giving way to the rhetorical momentum of the occasion.
Well, there we are. Another week in the Great War on Terror, and now with the Enron piece sitting there and domestic issues coming right back onto the stage.
Yeah, and a big scandal.
A big one. Jack, have a wonderful weekend.
You too.
See you next week. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is special coverage from WBUR Boston.